We are in 1 Kings chapter 6, only the first 14 verses. I'll do a lot of intro stuff after we read this section, but so this is 1 Kings chapter 6, starting in verse 1. In the 480th year after the children of Israel's exodus from the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he built the temple of the Lord. The temple that King Solomon built to the Lord, 60 cubits was its length, 20 cubits was its width, 30 cubits was its height. The hall in front of the sanctuary of the temple, 20 cubits was its length across the width of the temple, and 10 cubits its width in front of the temple. He made narrowing windows for the temple. Against the wall of the temple, he built an annex all around, built into the walls of the temple, all around the sanctuary and the inner sanctum. And he made cells all around. The lowest story of the annex, its width was 5 cubits. The middle story was 6 cubits wide. The third, 7 cubits width. For he had provided recesses around the outside of the wall of the temple in order not to penetrate the walls of the temple. When the temple was being built, it was built of complete quarried stone. Hammers, chisels, or any iron utensils were not heard in the temple when it was being built. The entrance to the temple, the ground level, cell, was at the south side of the temple. And they would ascend on a winding staircase to the middle story and from the middle story to the third. He built the temple and completed it. He made the temple ceiling of decorative panels under cedar planks. He built the annex along the entire temple, 5 cubits was its height, and he covered the house with cedar wood. The word of the Lord then came to Solomon, saying, "This temple that you build, if you follow my decrees, perform my statutes, and observe all my commandments to follow them, I shall uphold my word with you that I spoke to David your father. I shall dwell among the children of Israel, and I shall not forsake my people, Israel." So Solomon had built the temple and finished it. We're going to stop there at the end of verse 14. Those of you who have been with the last month or so, give or take, I covered in great extensively, to my mind, the vision of Ezekiel's temple, written in Ezekiel, and of course the corresponding vision for John for the same temple, and the altar that went with it. I had discussed and demonstrated, as far as the Bible is concerned, both Ezekiel's vision and John's, of course. We're not visually seeing structures. They were seeing what God wished them to see, which were not physical objects per se. They were spiritual objects written out in a physical form, which they wrote down. And the New Testament, of course, covered many ways as to why and what components that these men saw in their visions and how they correspond to human beings. The rocks, the utensils, the various furniture items that were inside of it, and how each one of those, the Bible points out, is this type of person or that type of person that God is using to build his temple. So the temple, when Messiah comes, with God, of course, it points out that there is no temple in New Jerusalem. It doesn't exist because it was never supposed to be existing. It was not a physical structure at all, because God and Messiah are the temple instead. And I pointed out last time the altar that was spoken of, also in Ezekiel's temple, and of course John was told to measure it as well. It is not necessarily a physical altar which you offer an animal on, but rather an altar which you offer gifts upon. And the gifts are not, according to the Bible, are not necessarily gifts of animals, but rather gifts of that God has given to you. And I rattle off a few of those gifts that the Spirit of God gives to you. And those things which we as people offer up to God in return, which he then, of course, shares with the others around. I covered those topics not only because Tammy had requested I do so, but that because I was going into, as I was covering through the prophet's study, I was approaching Solomon's temple, which of course he's building this structure. This structure is the prototype or the beginning temple which Ezekiel gets his vision from, meaning God's taking the components out of the structure that he has given to Solomon to build. He brings those into Ezekiel's time and he expands and alters them accordingly, but the components are all still there and the symbolism is still there for Ezekiel to see what God's actually designing, why the structure is built this particular way. And of course, also with John, when he saw this structure or something similar to it and measured it for Ezekiel to write the dimensions down. I covered those because I wanted you to understand that these components that Solomon has put into this temple were not by his own choice, per se. They're not, oh, he arbitrarily, I want to make this part gold. I'll make that part brass. I'll make it wasn't his arbitrary whim. They were designed and selected by God ahead of time to determine what components and what this temple was going to look like. Because they mean something to him, to God. He designed it ahead of time because it means something to us, the people. This temple is us. It is people. Each item that Solomon puts in this temple has a spiritual component to it. A spiritual component that we can use to apply to our own lives. And you will be part of that. That temple. That you're built to be, you're designed to be in it. We'll discuss that probably later on today. I'll also be discussing, of course, some of these details at the feast. Because I'll be covering some of the sacrifices that were done during the feast time according to the Torah. And how those sacrifices correspond to our current daily requirements that we are supposed to be doing to God continually, and what each of those elements mean and their corresponding measure or the percentage or amount. Before we go into great detail the prophecies regarding Solomon's temple and what is written here in the first 14 verses of this chapter, are there any questions or comments, things that caught your attention, your curiosity about what is being said here? Anything that I could answer a quick question off to start with? I guess not. Oh, yes.
It says no tools was found.
Was heard.
Heard, but they were like they were made perfect before they put it in the temple.
Yes.
And it's what in the spiritual speaking, we can't get in and be in the temple of God unless we're made perfect. So we're still being outside the temple being chiseled at.
Right, right. That's actually one of the points I'll be talking about today regarding that topic. There's different perspectives on it, of course. But Solomon built his temple in such a way and designed it in such a way, which I believe according to God's instruction, that the components, to put them together, it's like a build-your-own kind of kit. All the instructions of all the components of the quantity and size were given, already written out in dimensions. So they cut the quantity and put them, probably marked them of somehow, I don't know what goes where, as they were building it. So as it came to Solomon, the components that to put together were easily fit together, easily. I use that term obviously loosely because they were very heavy rocks. But they were put together, designed to fit together in a pattern, hence the temple's built. And he built it in such a way to not compromise the strength of the walls while he's building rooms into them. It was a very well-designed, well-built system, which many have argued, which I can't say that they're wrong. Back when, let's see, chapter 2? Oh, there it is, chapter 3. When it says, Solomon made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he took Pharaoh's daughter in marriage and brought her to the city of David until he finished building his house and the temple of the Lord and the wall of Jerusalem all around. Many have argued, which, again, I can't say that they're wrong, that because of this marriage alliance happening to correspond at a time when Egypt was at its growth spurt of its design of rock formations and buildings, was not just, she looks nice. Was not just, we'll make a marriage alliance so we don't get into wars against one another. But rather, it was a marriage alliance that she knew a whole lot more about rock building and building structures and design than the Israelites did. Have you ever seen or heard of the temple of the pyramids? I mean, there's a reason why Egypt was well known for those structures. And, of course, the massive tomb networks they put underneath the ground, which obviously we're very familiar with. It's been argued that that was a marriage of not just political necessity, but actually of convenience for him as well.
Wasn't that much later, though? Because Moses was much later, wasn't he?
Oh, no, that was Solomon's marriage.
Yeah, I know, but Moses was the time, I thought that the Israelites were under the bondage of Egypt, and we get the impression, maybe it's from the movie, The Ten Commandments, that they were No, it's really true. You know, they had to make straw and build.
They built. And note that during the, you know, they built two towns, not the pyramids. They built the two towns. The pyramids themselves are just a few of them. Egypt didn't stop with just a few pyramids. When the pyramids were being built, they were completed and they did their business there. Those were easily raided. They're found. I mean, you can see them from many miles away. They're easy for raiders to come and take. So Egypt then moved from building large external structures to underground structures. They've been doing that for many, many years, even after Moses' time and well into Solomon's time. They were building those structures. They still perceived that their pharaohs were still gods. Hence, they built those types of structures. So it was not exclusive to that time period. So pharaohs, the Egypt in particular, still had that skill. They did not lose or acquiesce the skill at all. And just because they stopped building external pyramid structures, they still built underground structures, built very similarly to the pyramids, actually. Just had to be underground versus above ground. So some have argued that's the case for why he married Pharaoh's daughter. I won't say it's right or wrong. It's just an argument. But either way, so this is what Solomon's deciding to do. We'll discuss some of the details behind it and what it means to us. Verse 1. In the 480th year after the children of Israel's exodus from the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he built a temple for the Lord. He did not finish the building of the temple. He's starting the temple at this time. It's actually on day number 2 of the second month, the second day of the month. 2 Chronicles chapter 3 records the actual date of second day of the month. 480 years. That is not an arbitrary number. It is coincidental. I will not tell you what the number means at this time, because that's for later. But, meaning not today. Yes, Richard, your comment? Write down, 400 years.
What I've done in my research on that particular date, all they did was, when the actions of God were involved, they counted just the years that God was doing something. And it came up to the exact same years. But taking away what man did, take that away, you come up with the exact number. That's fascinating.
It is fascinating. 480 years shows up more than once. This is 480 years where he starts building. I mean, he's starting to he makes the order, they start cutting ground and making room for the temple rocks to come through from Lebanon, mostly. 480 years, that's from them leaving Egypt, right? When the first temple, first tabernacle, was described in Exodus, I think it's chapter 27, I think it's when he starts describing it. That's all done the first year of them leaving Egypt. 480 years later, Solomon starts building this temple. Anyone know what happens to this temple? What happens to Solomon's temple? It gets wiped out and destroyed, right? Not completely leveled to the ground, but close to it. And then what do? That was done for 70 years after it was wiped out and destroyed. So 70 years... Okay, new marker. I'll go back to green, because green works. So, the 480 years, at the end of this time period, after Solomon starts building the temple, so we'll make a little time mark. So, he starts building the temple, 480 years, this is Egypt, this is Solomon's temple. 480 years later, temple number 2 was built. Temple 1, I'm going to put this a T over here for tabernacle. So, tabernacles described or being constructed in Moses' time. 480 years pass. Solomon then starts to build the temple in his time. 480 years later, temple number 2 is built at its time, or starting to be built at its time. Notice something? 400 and not quite 80. And I believe it's 420 years go by, and then that temple is wiped out. So there is no extra temple 3, but temple 2 is dead. It's like, okay, well, although it's, you know, coincidental, 480 is duplicated here and here, not quite there. Curious why. We'll discuss that shortly. They had 70 years of exile from this temple. So when was the temple destroyed? 410 years, actually, afterward. Well, the temple was wiped out because 70 years it was dead. So it was killed for 70 years. This temple was built. And then, that's built. This temple is then constructed, 400 years from Moses to here, from here to there. This temple's destruction, which happens at this point, 70 AD, yeah. Is there a connection between any of these? Let's see. So this one's 410. Oh, I put the 410 in the wrong place. That's what's wrong with me. 410 goes over here. Yeah, Tower of Babylon's there. 420 years versus 410 years. What's wrong with this? Why is... What's God trying to tell us in these numbers? Did God arbitrarily choose Messiah's arrival early? Was this 480 years just a coincidence that the same number of 480 years to the day, mind you. It wasn't to the years, to the day. Was that a coincidence by God? So I have a question. Is this a coincidence by God? Is that out of sequence? Seems to be. There's a pattern there somewhere. Haven't quite figured the pattern out, have we? We're going to come back to that. Keep that in mind shortly. We'll come back to it shortly to figure out what's God telling us in these sequences. Are these numbers arbitrary? Are they not arbitrary? We'll have to discuss that. But not quite yet. I just want you to think about that for now. We'll discuss it in a few minutes.
So you had 480 years from the tabernacle to the first temple,
right.
And 480 to the second temple, and then 420 to the destruction of the second temple.
Right. So the third temple is not built, right? That's what we're discussing. But not quite yet. Because let's say this differently. The 480 years were here. They had 40 years in the wilderness of that, but we won't discuss that too much today. There are 480 years here from the first and second temple, but only 410 of actual usage. And from the second temple to its destruction, I'll give you a hint. There were 410 years of actual usage. 10 years that did not use the second temple. We'll discuss that. We'll discuss that. There is a reason. God didn't arbitrarily choose numbers. They actually mean something. There was 410 years. They did not use it. The 410 years used it. There were 10 years they did not use it while it was being rebuilt. Verse number 2. Oh, sorry. I'm not finished verse 1, number 1 yet. I apologize for missing something. This says Solomon begins this in the 480th year. It takes him 11 years to build it before it's completed. It says it starts him in the fourth year of his reign, right? And he's done it, starts in the second month, right? When was Solomon inaugurated as king? Anybody know? Let's go back and read that. Let's go back to 1 Kings. This is in chapter... Get my notes written here. Chapter 1, verse 32. There are a lot of pages here, but chapter 1. King David said, "Summon Zadok the Kohen, Nathan the prophet, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada to me." And they came before the king. The king said to them, "Take with your master's servants and mount my son Solomon upon my mule and take him down to Gihon. There, Zadok the Kohen, Nathan the prophet, shall anoint him as king over Israel. Sound the shofar and proclaim, long live King Solomon. Then come back up after him, and let him come and sit upon my throne. He shall reign in my place, for it is whom I have commanded to become ruler over Israel and Judah. Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, then asked the king, saying, Amen, and so may the Lord, God of my lord the king, say, Just as the Lord was with my lord the king, so may he be with Solomon, and may he make his throne even greater than the throne of my lord the king David. So Zadok the Kohen and Nathan the prophet and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada and the archers and slingers went down and mounted Solomon upon David's mule and led him to Gihon. Zadok the Kohen had taken the horn of oil from the tent and anointed Solomon. They sounded the shofar and all the people proclaimed, Long live King Solomon. All the people then ascended after him. The people were playing flutes to rejoice with great joy. The ground virtually burst from their noise. Adonijah and all the guests who were with him heard this. And just as they had finished eating, Joab heard the sound of the shofar. And he said, Why is the sound of the city so turbulent? He was still speaking when Jonathan, son of Abiathar, the Kohen, came. And I said, Come, for you are a man of accomplishment, and you will bring good tidings. And Jonathan answered the king, said to the contrary, Our Lord King David has made Solomon king. The king has set with him Zadok the Kohen, Nathan the prophet, and Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, and the archers and slingers. They mounted upon the king's mule. Zadok the Kohen and Nathan the prophet anointed him as king at Gihon. They ascended there rejoicing, and the city became turbulent. That is noise which you have heard. For the morning Solomon is set upon the royal throne. The king's servants have come to bless our lord, King David, saying, May God grant Solomon a reputation even greater than your own. And may he make his throne even greater than your throne. And the king prostrated himself upon his bed. For the morning the king has said, Thus blessed the Lord God, who has granted me today someone who sits upon my throne, and my eyes can see it. All of Adonijah's guests were alarmed and rose. Each man went his way. Adonijah was afraid of Solomon. So he rose and went to Kol, the horns of the altar. And Solomon told, Behold, Adonijah is afraid of the king. Solomon said, Behold, he has taken hold of the horns of the altar, saying, Let the king Solomon swear to his day he will not execute his servant by the sword. And we'll go into the rest of the story. Does that tell you when this took place? No, it doesn't. What does it tell you? Regarding Solomon's inauguration. I need another board. The backside doesn't. There's not a marker board. The backside's a backing board. Okay, verbally I'll tell you. Solomon's made king at a particular time of year. What time? We don't know yet, but we'll discuss the details. What is David giving? What orders are he instructed? He says, You will take Solomon down to Gihon, anoint him, put him on a mule, and blow the shofar and walk him up to Jerusalem. Then, of course, Nathan the prophet, and they go do precisely that. They take Solomon's mule, anoint him, blast the shofar, song, mute, flutes and such were going as well, and they brought him to Jerusalem. Joab hears the sound of shofar and is told that King Solomon, or Solomon is now king. Any of that sound remotely familiar to you? What does it sound familiar about? What's so familiar about it? Yeshua is very similar, right? What three things are mentioned in this story? How many times are they mentioned? Three times. What do you see when you see number three? The city's mentioned three times, the shofar's mentioned three times, the mule's mentioned three times. Actually, I shouldn't say the city. More accurately, the throne, technically. City slash throne. It's supposed to remind you, as I mentioned when I covered chapter 1, that it was supposed to remind you of Messiah's triumphant entry into Jerusalem. I told you, hey, they are mirroring images of one another. Messiah sits on a mule, which he purposely found, of course written by King David, when 1 Kings was written out, well, him himself and his people, about the mule will be required. So Messiah, of course, took the mule to match the prophecies accordingly, which were written about that. He takes a shofar, which is a great sound and blast. What is a shofar supposed to announce or do? To announce a great thing, usually a coming king. And of course, he sits upon the throne of the king, throne of David, of course, he's being announced for. So question, what is this coming Tuesday? They have massive blowing. Now, granted, silver trumpets versus shofar, but the same principle. What's this supposed to symbolically mean? The coming of the king to do what? To sit upon the throne of God, or God's throne, to take over rulership. So, is it coincidental that the three primary elements, and the mule, by the way, for those of you who are unaware, mule equals firstborn. For those requirements to be centered around trumpets, is it coincidental that Solomon's exact imagery is around those same symbols? Is it coincidental?
Of course not.
Yeah, right. Pure coincidence, right? Nothing's coincidental. It's not coincidental, is it? If God is using, Baru, as far as I'm concerned, every syllable in this Bible is God-inspired, so he didn't make a mistake. So, if God used this symbolism and said, all right, this is all these symbols surround trumpets, and says, look, here's all of these symbols, what does it tell you about this event here? They're the same or similar events, the announcement or the anointing of a king. Solomon, I argue, was probably anointed based on what Adonijah did when he was anointed, when he took throne, not anointed, he took the throne, as far as the sacrificing of the animals and such, which happened to be Sukkot animals. So Solomon was anointed or selected as king using the exact same symbols as trumpets. Is it possible Solomon's anointing is supposed to remind you of trumpets? Whether it took place on a February, in January, or August makes no difference. The symbols are designed to remind you of trumpets. That's what they're built in to do that. It clearly does. There's no mistake, at least the symbols remind you of. Those symbols remind you of trumpets. What's 3.5 years later? It's in the middle of Solomon's fourth reign. Passover. Well, the middle of Solomon's reign, he starts building this thing on the second month, the first day, or second day of the second month in his fourth year. That's the month of the year, meaning whenever he was anointed, we don't know. But in the middle of his fourth year, which happens to correspond to about 3.5 years after trumpets, normally in the time cycle, it actually is that or near to it, within a few days. Within a few days of trumpets, 3.5 years go by as Solomon starts building a temple. Now we know 3.5 years go by, because it took him 3 years to consolidate the reign. It says that in the previous chapter. So he took in to kill all of David's enemies and bad people and such, blah, blah, blah. So we know that much actually did happen. So, is it coincidental that we're given the imagery of trumpets, and then 3.5 years later we're given the building of the house of God? Because Solomon is a messianic figure. What happened with Messiah? We know Messiah dies in Passover. He serves for 3.5 years, right? So there's 3.5 years prior to Passover. That would be trumpets. So the Messiah starts his work around the trumpets time, near approaching. We don't know the exact day. It doesn't matter. 3.5 years later, he dies. And what's he do once he's dead and resurrected? What's he tell people he's supposed to go do now? And doing what? Preparing a place for you, huh? Right, he's preparing a place for you, isn't he? What would you call that place he's preparing? I would call it a temple. With lots of small rooms that Solomon built in it. Office buildings, whatever you wish to argue. I'll take the small corner one, office here. No, that's the point. The symbolism that Solomon's doing here, written out in 1 Kings, is the same symbolism that Messiah lived through and declared he was going to go do. If those symbolisms are the same, was this God-inspired? The timing of it as well as the construction? Absolutely. They built each other upon one another. They designed, they grasped each other, and they pulled from. Messiah said he's written about in the Torah. Not just what he is, but what he does is written here too. His actions are built here too. So in the prophecies, we study this 1 Kings 6 and 7 and 8 and 9, all, a number of chapters afterward. They discuss what this temple looks like and what's in it. Those elements and components, Solomon starts building at a coincidental time that the Messiah says he's going to start building. 3.5 years, slightly over, after Messiah starts Because Uzziah, of course, he comes, he's around for 40 days, because then he goes off, right? So there's a period of time after Passover, Messiah is still hanging around in the spirit slash physical form. I'm not quite sure what that looks like, but it doesn't matter. So Messiah's hanging out for a little bit after his death. Well, Solomon starts this a little bit after, 3.5 years later. Right about the time when Messiah would start it, to start building the temple. Now, this is some of the key elements here. So Solomon's starting this at the right time, which is great, just prophetic according to Messiah's schedule. He's very good at that. What I want to point out to you in this is that, as Richard pointed out when he asked me, he pointed to the question, the sound of the chisels and the utensils and such were not heard in the temple, right? Meaning they were built and chiseled and constructed elsewhere. From rock somewhere else. And not associated with Jerusalem, not associated with Israel at all. Matter of fact, they're built mostly in Lebanon. Totally outside of the country, majority of them. It's like he's building it not with the stones of Israel, rather building it with the Gentiles outside of Israel. Because as the New Testament points out, each rock here in Solomon's temple and Ezekiel's temple and Messiah's temple are human beings that are being built and cut and carved to match, to fit wherever they fit. We don't know what it looks like. It doesn't make a difference. But that's what they're designed for. In the symbolism here that Solomon's given, which he's given in the previous chapter, and a chapter before that as well, he used foreigners, meaning non-Israelite people, non-religious people, to ship them off to another country, in this particular case, Lebanon, to build and cut the chisels and everything else up there. Then haul the rocks and the wood down here, not using any Israelites to do it. Using foreigners, non-biological blood people of Israel, to build this temple. Sound familiar at all? It should. What's Messiah using when he's cutting up each of us? Read it. You're going to cite it, read it. It should look like he's using people that are outside of Israel, gathering them together away from, I will dare use the word, Judaism or the life cycle of what is in the Torah. Outside of that, gathering these stones, cutting and chiseling away, and importing them in. You could argue that Ephraim, outside other territories, was definitely outside of Jerusalem that much. It's like he's gathering the remnants that nobody wants, and using those and chiseling those and forming those to bring in, not the pristine or precisely built Israelites. Just an argument. Let's make a hand up.
Time in Egypt, them hewing stones and doing the hard work at that time.
I would argue
it's
similarly.
The foreigners.
Right, exactly. Using the foreigners to do it, it's you're taking, how else to word this? Don't take it to mean that I'm saying that all foreigners should be the consistency or the temple's built solely of foreign people. That's not what I'm arguing at all. I'm just pointing out that this temple is built in that fashion. The outside people, away from the temple area, away from Jerusalem completely, were cutting and forming these stones to be brought into, to be used by the people and residents of the temple of Israel, not to be used by the foreigners themselves. It's kind of interesting parallelism there. But yes, Egypt was built the exact same way, in that they used, well, not all, at least two cities were. They're built by using Israel as its components to be brought in, cut the stones or build them, however you should argue it, were brought in to construct and build, that were going to be used by only the Egyptians. It's slave labor. But who would not want to be a slave to God? So I would be a welcome blessing to be his slave. That's just a separate issue, a separate topic. So this temple is using components and rocks, not part of Israel. It's using wood too, also not from Israel, to be built and constructed for Israel. Same way the Messiah has been doing it. Because remember, his own people rejected him, right? Then what did he do? He went to the rest of them and used them. chiseled and cut them and bringing them to build his house. Romans 11, oh, sorry, hold on. Romans 11, she wished, well, hold on. Let me ask Bill's question first. Go ahead.
Yeshua said, destroy this temple and I'll raise it up again in three days.
Yep. Now, he was telling specifically at that time about his body,
yeah.
But he points out in that statement, this temple is symbolic of his body.
Yeah.
He's using that symbolism there. He's tying them together. And of course, we already know this temple, not Solomon's, but the temple of God's building is, of course, built upon stones, rocks and stones, made up of what? Well, according to the Bible, it says made up of the apostles and the prophets. They are the foundational base stones. They're what everything is built upon. Rose, we wish to read Romans chapter 11.
Well, I'll start in verse 7.
Thank you. What then?
Israel has not obtained that which he seeks for, but the election has obtained it, that the rest were blinded. According as it is written, God has given them the spirit of slumber and eyes that they should not see and ears that they should not hear. Unto this day. And David said, let their table be made a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a recompense unto them. Let their eyes be darkened that they may not see and bow down their back always. And I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall? God forbid. But rather through their fall, salvation has come unto the Gentiles for to provoke them to jealousy. Now if the fall of them be the riches of the world and the diminishing of them the riches of the Gentiles, how much more their fullness? For I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am the apostle of the Gentiles, I magnify the office. For if by any means I may provoke to emulation them which are my flesh, and might save of some of them, for of the casting away of them be the reconciling of the world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from dead? For if the first fruits be holy, and the lump also is holy, and if the root be holy, so are the branches. And if some of the branches were broken off, and thou, being a wild olive tree, wert grafted in among them, and with them partake of the root and the fatness of the olive tree, boast not against the branches. But if thou boast, thou bearest not the root, but the root thee. Thou wilt say then, the branches were broken off, that I might be grafted in. Well, because of unbelief they were broken off, and you stand by faith. Be not high-minded, but fear. For if God so spared not the natural branches, take heed lest he also spare not thee. Behold, therefore, the goodness and the sovereignty of God on them which fell. Severity, I mean, but toward thee goodness. But if thou continue in his goodness, otherwise thou also shall be cut off.
Essentially, that's exactly what I was pointing out, what she just read off, is that symbolism is being built in, was built in to use people who were not native, or in this case, stones, not native to Israel, not native to that particular area, Jerusalem in particular, and brought out from others to fill that void, to fill that space that Jerusalem could not fill. Now, those of you who don't know the story or the history of Jerusalem in particular, the territory that Solomon God chose to build this temple on was a little bit depressed, meaning it was under, not financially depressed. I mean, physically, there was valleys and areas which no flat foundation could be built. Solomon used those rocks in Jerusalem to level the ground first. Then he built this on top of it. So it's not, in that same exact story, in what you just read there, those foundational stones, or those wild olive branches, were put upon directly on top of Jerusalem's rocks, or roots. That's what was built upon. Those Jerusalem's territory, that is the foundation, the base, that is the roots, the olive tree, it's the same thing. They're all arguing the same symbolism being used. God teaches through repetition. So he teaches again and again and again, using different symbols, teaches the same exact thing until we finally get it. Most of us get it, God willing, before we die. Some of us don't, but that's for him to figure out. Okay, so far in the temple structure, you get a general idea of what it looks like. Well, I mean, not really. I just kind of gave you a little general idea here. Solomon continues on in his building. I'm not going to read through all of this. I'm going to be short on time. But Solomon's dimensions, those of you who are students and noticed this, maybe you would notice, maybe you wouldn't. Solomon chose double dimensions of the tabernacle. Tabernacle, was 30 by 10, this one, 60 by 20. For the side of the tabernacle, the Holy of Holies was 10 by 10, this one's 20 by 20. The outer wall was 20 by 10, this one's 40 by 20. He doubled the size, except he made it three times taller instead of twice as tall.
Why?
Good question. Let's find out. What's the number three mean? Messiah. We'll just do number three here. This is the ground floor. This is 5, 6, and 7. 5, 6, and 7. Those are the wall sizes. Solomon made room for 18 feet, which the tabernacle did not have. 18 feet wide. The height, he made this thing 30 cubits. So each story is 10 cubits. So this is, it's 5 foot wide, it's 10 tall. 10 and 10. Making a 30 cubit building, roughly. Solomon made room for two more groups of people. The tabernacle did not have. The tabernacle had room for Israel. That's what it was designed for. In particular, the Levites. That's who it was specifically designed for. The tabernacle was designed for Levites to go into. Did anybody else get to go into there? No. Levites got to go in there. Well, when Solomon built his temple, who did he want to go in there? Levites, of course. But who else? Strangers to God, in a manner of speaking. Levites, it was designed specifically around Levites, which is the Holy of Holies sanctuary, which is this little dotted area along here. All of this region along here, the walls, which contain all the individual rooms, who gets to go in there? We do. Well, sort of. It's kind of like our houses. There are business places, which they're used for business. And also storage houses, too, which are also part of us. Solomon made room for not only the Levites, which are here, which take care of the actual sanctuary territory itself, which consists of the tabernacle. The ministers, essentially. Well, sort of like. Some of them are, some of them aren't. So they're servants. So Levites are there. Who lives in the outer temples, or outer tabernacle territories? Well, who else is not allowed in the temple? Gentiles is one group. Who else wasn't allowed in? The unclean, sort of. Non-Levite man. So who is that? Yeah. So we'll say Israel was not allowed in. But the funny thing about Solomon, he always did this, so did David. They always separated Judah from Israel. They never included them as the same. They isolated them. So Israel is everybody except the tribe of Judah, who's its own category. Solomon made room for the rest of everybody else to go in. Is that not what Messiah is supposed to do? He's making room for everybody. Does not matter your nationality per se, although it's important, it does count for some things. Solomon had to increase the capacity. So he made it three times bigger to count for that many more that could not go in before. Solomon increased the height of it. It is now three times the height. That's tall. Well, I'm not 9 feet tall. A cubit is almost 2 feet. So this is a 60-foot tall building. I'm not going to be 20 feet. you can be 10 feet tall if you wish. No, I'm good where I am. No, that's the design, what he built. Now, he wasn't just an arbitrary builder. There's something he did very unique, which, in my mind, supports the reasoning for this three-story building. It's how he built the walls. What happens? Have you ever been into a two-story building before? How many have been into a three or more story building before? Are the outer walls the same spot on the second story, for the most part, as they are on the first? Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. Let's pretend your three-story building is 60 feet tall. Are the outer walls, very close or near to, the same height or position as from the top to the bottom? We're not accounting for wind or earthquakes. When they're built, have you ever seen a skyscraper that has goes up here and then stops, and then comes walls over here and stops? They do make a few of them, but not very many. Not very many. They go smaller. Some do. Some do, some don't. Solomon, but the design of that is unique, and that those buildings, including this one we have right here on this wall, if I wish to build a second story, my supports, meaning most of the story is supported by the same wall that is part of the first story. Most. There are a few exceptions. You can put posts or beams occasionally here, but the majority of it, the first floor walls support the second story's walls. Do they not?
Right.
Right. And the, exactly. And the second story walls are more or less similarly supported by the first and second stories, the third story. They're all supported. They're, for the most part, straight up and down. For the most part. There are exceptions in unique architectural work. I'm not discussing those. As a general, it's how they're built. What does that mean, then, for the people on the third story? They're being supported by the people on the second and the first story. Right? That's what it would mean. That's the design. Now, you're rocks. Pretend you're rocks. You're part of this wall. So, let's say you're a guy, and God builds you as a rock and cuts you out and puts you right here.
That's good, yeah.
So, everybody above you is standing on you. Right? Theoretically, that's what the foundational stones are built for. That's exactly what they're built for. Did Solomon build his temple that way? Not exactly. No. He only built the foundational stones that way. The walls, the second story is not supported by the first story. And the third story is not supported by the second. They stand independent of each other. If something goes wrong in the first story, the second and third are completely independent, have no care or concern. He did it brilliantly. And also, build your own kit style, which is how he built the whole temple, was to build the parts outside of it. I'm going to erase this and draw my little figure up here in a larger view. Yes, an upside-down wedding cake is exactly how he built it. It's actually quite brilliant and simple in the design. I erased some of this stuff, it's not important. The outer walls where all of our houses or rooms or mansions, you argue them, are being built and are designed this particular way. So we have a ground, right? So we'll pretend this is the ground. In the wall, he built all these rooms. The outer wall, we'll say this is the outer wall, and here's the sanctuary wall. Now, this is the actual crust of just a single wall. The actual rooms is all over here where I'm standing right here. Okay, so this is just one zoomed in view of a wall. He built, as it says here, the first floor was 5 cubits, the second was 6, and the third was 7 wide. So the first floor is 5 cubits wide. I'll put a big 5 here. The second story is 6. The third story, didn't exactly draw it to scale, is 7. And what did he build? That's the cross-section of the wall itself. He put the floor as cypress boards and cedar. So he put on these little ledges wood. So, oh, he also has a roof. Sorry, there's a roof here too. Yeah, you could walk on top. If you so chose. He built the walls in such a way that the board that supports the third story, number 7, it is not being supported, if you look straight down, it is not underneath, or not above, any of the wall that supports number 2 or number 5. Or, sorry, number 2 or number 1. It's independent. It's built solely by itself. 6 is done the same way. So let's say, for example, there was a flood, or maybe, no, a fire. Let's say a fire. A fire destroys number 5. There wasn't. Well, there was eventually, but not it. What happens to story number six? Well, although the floor is made out of woods, be careful of that. The walls, it stays supported. It's independent. It doesn't require number five to exist. Meaning it doesn't require the five cubit width wall to exist. Six doesn't use number five's walls, which are covered by wood here, to support itself. It doesn't use them at all. My point is, each room in Solomon's temple stands alone. It's actually a brilliant design. I have a question for you, just to cement this idea. You believe in God, right? Does your belief in God require Joe Schmuck 800 years ago to have also believed in God? So you're not standing on Joe Schmuck's ideas, are you? Maybe that's a schmuck, fair enough. Okay, I'll change his name. Something else. It doesn't matter what his foundation was or wasn't, because all of you technically are standing on the exact same original foundation stones, not requiring the one below you to support you. Only requires foundational stone to support you. It's actually a brilliant design in that it's simple to build, requires very little labor as far as after it's being started. They don't have to cut notches in the walls, which of course weaken them, to build these stories. They're all self-sufficient, or they all believe or stand upon God alone or by themselves, not requiring one another to do it. They all stand on the exact same prophets, the exact same apostles. I don't stand on Joe Schmuck number 1, 2, or 3, because he happened to stand on the Suzy Q before him, and then she stood. I'm not requiring this long chain to believe or follow God. I can follow it completely independent of what anybody else is doing, even though I'm three stories up in the air, and they're not, or vice versa. Does that make sense? That's the design of what God built. So I don't have to worry about whether, for example, whether my father follows God or not. I don't have to worry about whether, or you don't have to worry about what your dad did or didn't do, or what your mom did or didn't do. You are completely and solely accountable by yourself what you are or are not. It's what you stand on or don't stand on. That's what it's built for. That's what the inside the wall, where all the, not so many Gentiles, you have to be at least a good Gentile, where the rest of Israel is allowed to go and do their business with God. Buy or sell, or if they happen to offer where the gifts would go, various things of that nature. That's what they do. Those are the spaces that your gifts go to, or that you get to go to and attend and be part of. You don't require somebody else to do it for you or require them to have done it already. You are independent. Does that make sense? But still, you're all part of the same structure. It's a brilliant design. It's very well done. And it's simple and can be built off-site and all brought here independent. Solomon can put these stones wherever he wants them to be. They'll all be put brought outside and brought in there manually, put where they belong, and he covers the whole thing, of course, with cedar, as it discusses here too. So, it's a complete quarried stone. So Solomon's building, as I erased my earlier picture, he's building. Through verse 14, it focuses solely upon the walls, the outer walls of the tabernacle itself. The rest of chapters will discuss as far as what the inner walls and what the sanctuary looks like and the various other details. But he felt it was important to build it this particular way. And after he had built these constructions, the design of the walls, that's when God comes in verse 11, and gives him a vision or a communication of some form. And God felt it was important for Solomon to hear this. Because note, up to this point, these walls, they have nothing to do with the tabernacle that was spoken of by Moses, other than their location. Solomon built them first. So right before Solomon's about to begin, the components that God is actually associated with, meaning the tabernacle, the Holy of Holy Sanctuaries, all the components and all the utensils, right before Solomon's about to start that project next, God comes and says, okay, hold on a minute before you go there. This is what I have to say to you. In verse 12, this temple that you build, if you follow my decrees and perform my statutes and observe all my commandments, so follow them, I shall uphold my word with you that I spoke to David your father. I shall dwell among the children of Israel, and I shall not forsake my people Israel. So right before Solomon starts the actual area that God is going to be in, God says to him, now that you've done this outer work, that's great, whatever, it doesn't make a difference. That was Solomon's vision and design, which is perfectly fine, that's great. And God gave that to him, in my opinion. But right before he messes with the part that God's going to be in, God says, all right, here's a condition. Now that you're starting this, which you're now building, you have to follow my decrees and my statutes and my commandments for me to be here. That's God's requirement. So, if I'm in this room up here, in number, let's say, I'll pretend I'm on the second floor. I like second floors, they're nice. So I'm pretending I'm right here, right? So I'm a little me standing, or you standing, makes no difference. So I'm standing in this little room. Little, so it's not that big. It's not that little, it's pretty good sized. It's 12 feet, you know what it is. So I'm standing there. What's my requirement to be there? Well, God said he will uphold my word with you that I spoke to David your father and shall dwell among the children of Israel and I shall not forsake my people. So for God, for say, I would not be here unless there was a reason. So I have a reason to be in this second floor or third floor anyway. I have a reason to be there. And what is that reason? That I, referring to God, will dwell among the children of Israel. I shall not forsake my people. If you watch the statutes. So, for me to be here, I have to have a reason to be here, right? I'm not going to just arbitrarily say, oh, this is a good place to strike a tent. This is, I'm here for a purpose. That purpose is what? Well, to be with God, or do some association with God in some fashion. So, although this is my wall, well, I'm out of room again. I should get a bigger whiteboard. I have like three stories. That's basically my old diagram. It's rough sketch. Okay, so I'm here, and I'm sitting in this room. I like corner offices. I don't have one, but I like one. So I'm sitting in this little room here. I'm waiting. I'm there for what reason? I'm waiting for, or therefore, because God is here. He's hanging out there. You see him? He's hanging out there. My reason for being in this room is because God is in this room. That's the purpose. That's why I want to be there. If God wasn't here, do I have any reason to be there? No, it's just a building which isn't very pleasant. It's kind of, you know, a little drafty. The windows don't have good shutters. And it's all rock, too. How do you heat that up? So, although it is a good neighborhood, it's also, anyway. So I have no reason to be there unless God's there, right? What did God say his requirement for him to be there would be? Solomon. If you follow my decrees and perform my statutes, observe my commandments to follow them, then I shall uphold my word with you, as spoke to David your father, that I will be among the children of Israel. So for God to be here, to hang out in this little spot, not that he lives there, it's symbolic, of course. So hanging out in this spot, for him to be there, what's Solomon have to do? Solomon has to follow all the laws, the obey God. That's a better way of writing it. Thank you. Obey God. That's the requirement for Solomon. I'm not Solomon, though, am I? I'm just a Joe Q, whatever. Over here in this... I have to be nice to schmucks. So I'm Joe Q over here. I'm not Solomon, so do I have to obey God? Of course I do. What if I don't? Guess what? You don't get to be here. Sorry. You stay out here then, buddy. That's life. Tough luck. So if Solomon's job, which means, of course, leadership in the country as a nation as a whole, their job is to obey all the rules and regulations that God has set for them to obey. For God to be here, my job for me to be in this room, guess what? I have to do what Solomon's has to do. I have the same rules and requirements. Nothing changes. I am not better than Solomon that I get to be here without having to do anything. I'm not better than Solomon. I'm not better than Moses or Aaron or even the prophets or apostles. What did they have to do? They had to live and die according to what was right. And they got to be the rocks that I'm standing on top of. So they're the rocks, or part of the rocks, not all of them, but some of them, part of the rocks that I'm standing on top of for me to stand in this room with a little kippah on. So my requirement to be here is the same requirement God gave to Solomon for God to be here. Follow those rules. Do not stand upon anybody else, Solomon. Do not stand upon anybody else, Joe Q or Daniel A.G. in this particular case. You're standing on your own room. You are your own rock. Your rock is supporting nothing else other than one above you, but you're not dependent upon the room beneath you. You're dependent solely upon the same foundation everybody's built upon. And all those guys that built this foundation, what did they do? See this big, they obeyed God. Same thing. Now granted, they did a better job, they're far superior than I am, they got it written about. But they had to do the same thing. Does that make sense? What was that?
The book of Acts isn't finished yet. There's no way
to it. That's true. The house is not finished being built in my direction, right. In that Solomon's vision, what he has here, took him, I think it was 11 years. I could be wrong. 7 years. Sorry, 7 years to build this. It took him longer to build his own house. He designed changes. Took him 7 years to build this one that he built, and he finished it, actually, near around trumpets. Much how his reign as king began. He dedicates it then. And his 11th reign, 7 years later. At trumpets, or near to it. If we argued, it's in the 7th month. We don't know if it's trumpets, or whether it's, someday in that month, he dedicates it. So Solomon finishes this construction and declares, now God, you may dwell here. And guess what God does? He fills it up. He shows up, he comes. So did Solomon do right? Because God will not follow. If you break the covenants, sorry, there are punishments to it. And in Solomon's case, when he built this temple, he obeyed. He did exactly what God told him to do. Obey, and I will dwell here. 7 years later, he obeyed, still, for that time period. And God then said, now I will dwell here. Now I, Daniel A.G., have a reason to be on story number 2, preferably in the corner office, with window. Yes. Yes, Bill.
Would that be doing the works that we're supposed to be doing?
In many ways, yes. These men, yeah, many good works. And these men who wrote these foundational laws, let's pretend for a moment you are Moses number 2. So Bill is Moses number 2. Moses the 2nd. You want to be like Moses. If you wish to be a foundational stone, you'll be just like him. Well, you obviously aren't going to be, no offense, but he's Moses and you're not. But you want to be like him. Meaning, you're going to look at what he did in his life, aren't you? If you wish to be like him, what do you get? First thing, if I say, you have to be just like him, what's your first task? Find out what he is and who the him is. What did the him do? I want to be like him. What is him? Who is he? What's your first task to be Moses the 2nd? You have to study or read or find out who Moses the 1st was. We'll call Moses. Oh, that's Moses I. We'll call it just Moses 1. Okay. That's your job. If you wish to be Moses the 2nd, what is Moses the 1st? What did he do? How did he live his life? You won't be Moses the 1st, but you wish to be like him. If you are like him, what does God then do with you? You become a rock. No, you become a rock. And you are well shaped to fit right wherever God wants you to fit because you looked and said, what am I, as a rock, going to stand on? I'm going to stand on Moses the First to be just like him, and I will call my name Moses the Second. Well, I won't. God would. So if anybody works, what did Moses do? Did he show his faith by his works? Do you remember his story well? Same thing as Abraham. What did he do? What did they do? If you wish to be like them, what did they do? God brought those men up and said, these are good, righteous men. These are good examples. My son, Messiah, is even a greater example. But they are righteous men that you're looking at. If you wish to be a stone or a rock or someplace important, useful, in the temple, to be stand on those men, you better know exactly what those men did and be strong like them. And what did God say they were? A righteous men. So what do you want to be? A righteous man. How do you be a righteous man? Study righteous men and duplicate what they do. Study Messiah, duplicate what he did. Study the apostles, duplicate what they did. So your faith is then proven by your works. Because if you do it right, if you follow them as best you can, your faith, which is to desire to become a rock, which you haven't become one yet, none of us have, to be a rock will be proven. It will come through. It will happen. Do what they did. They believed and feared only God, not men. God doesn't change. We do. We change all the time. He's always the same. So if his rules are the same, his desire is the same. His intent is the same. And he gave you, I don't know, probably 1,000 some odd examples of people both doing good and bad of what you should and shouldn't do. And how the shouldn'ts didn't turn out so well and the shoulds did turn out well. To be like a should and you do well. Be like Messiah. Be like Moses. Be like Aaron. Don't go the way of Cain. Yes. That makes sense? You're going to stand on somebody, and it's the foundational stones. Make sure you know what they are and what you're standing on and be like them. Else, you're really not a very good, well-built stone, are you? Yeah. You're built on a crumbly nothingness. Make sense? Okay. Any questions? Yes, Jeff.
Well, when you talk about the language of the temple and such, one of the great passages comes to mind is in Romans 12. I'm talking about Romans 11. Romans 12, starting in verse 1. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect.
Yes,
one of the great promises of this is to be transformed. In other words, to be hewn.
Yeah, to be cut, to be
to
built.
To be cut. And one of the great promises of the new covenant is that we will have a new heart and that God will cut us and fashion us through his spirit.
As I wound up reading Romans 12 for 2 weeks ago because but for the rest of the chapter Romans 12 because of that exact same reason. As I was covering the altar, the things you give, the good things you give to God, those offerings and the sacrifices bring to you, and what are they? They consist of these components. To be that rock, to be that stone, or to be that person hanging out here, what am I actually doing there? Now that I made it there, what am I actually going to do? Well, I'm going to bring something to the one who's hanging out here, known as God. I'm going to be a good stone, a good foundational stone. I'm going to be part of that temple. I'm going to be bringing those gifts to God's altar as he commanded me to bring, which, of course, Romans 12 lists a number of them. Yes, Richard. Oh, which question was it?
480.
Yeah, 480. Sorry. Thank you. I got distracted. Okay. I'm out of time, but forgive me. So I will cover. I'll get short and dirty, quick and dirty. 410 years. This was in operation 410 years. Act actually, technically, so was this one. The time period between the destructions and the rebuilding is a pattern to watch and note. But the time period of their actual usage is more important to note. 410 years, Solomon's temple was being built, was being used as a temple. 70 years, it was not. This temple, from the second period until Messiah's death, it was destroyed partly. And it took them time to rebuild it to be functional again. That combined time of it not being functional happens to be 10 years. So the second temple was used, not the same day, but close to it, the same number of years as Solomon's temple was used. And God said, enough's enough. Make sense? So this 480, 480, and 420 are there to note your attention, to look deeper and figure out what's going on here. To note that 410 years it was used, 410 years it was used. So God was counting. It's pretty close to it. Yeah, it's pretty close to it. Okay, that's fair enough. Yeah, that's pretty accurate. 790 years. It's a long time. I'm not sure what that number means, but John might know. Any questions about this? It's simple. It's a simple thing. But it's something to note that God actually was counting. Which, of course, always brings you to the tension of the holy days, and in particular, of course, the Jubilee years that God is counting. What's he counting? Well, in this case, he was clearly counting the number of years these stones were useful until the time was up. And they said, these stones are now done. Let's build it again with new stones. Until that last one got destroyed, and now the building with new stones are not physical structures, but rather human beings instead. God willing. I don't want to be replaced. So yes, hopefully I'm not the I don't want to be a first to get wiped out.